Without further ado, if you're cool, we'll kick it off.
Great.
All right. 3, 2, 1. Good afternoon. Joe Boma here again with another Grit City story. Today I'm with Katie, the curator of the Museum of Glass. How you doing today, Katie?
Good morning. How are you?
I am doing great. It's great to be here at this awesome museum that is it's a very symbolic of Tacoma. You can't see a postcard or a picture without seeing the massive hot shop cone dome on the side.
It's true, and if you dig into how we ended up here on the Foss Waterway, it's a really interesting inflection point for Tacoma's like turnaround in the late 1990s.
Well, I mean, if you want to dive right into that, I'd love to hear how this place helped turn Tacoma around.
Sure, sure. So back in, I double-checked, 1992, Dr. Phil Phibbs, who had just retired as the president of UPS, was sitting with Dale Chihuly, a glass artist you may have heard of from the area.
Heard it, you know, one or three dozen times already.
Yeah, he's only the guy. But they were having a conversation about why this region in the Northwest is so important to glass as an art movement, and they wondered if the amount of impact the Northwest and Tacoma has had on glass made it worth having a glass museum here. So Dr. Phibbs, the way the story goes is that Dr. Phibbs just invited himself to a city council meeting, expecting to be totally shot down. But he ended up there at a really opportune time because the Executive Council for Greater Tacoma was discussing how to use a federal grant to clean up the Foss Waterway. So back in the early 90s, it was pretty industrial on the waterfront, and Tacoma actually qualified for a Superfund cleanup grant.
It was that bad.
But they were looking for a way to use that grant to revitalize the downtown core of Tacoma.
Oh, that's nice.
A new art museum is kind of a nice way to do it.
Definitely.
So that caught the attention of city council and our other founder, George Russell Jr., who Russell Investments, you know, big family here in Tacoma. and they basically like shoehorned us into the waterfront as a way to connect the History Museum and Tacoma Art Museum with this new revitalized other side of the railway tracks.
Yeah, that's essentially. So you got wicked lucky on placement,
so lucky.
Money.
Right place, right time. You just had to sign on to being above toxic sludge. Which they cleaned out happily. And the
always a positive.
In the late 90s, they secured Canadian architect Arthur Erickson to kind of dream up the icon, like you were saying, the iconic cone shape that makes our museum.
Yes.
If you haven't been here, on the south end of the building, there's a giant silver cone that is the 7,000 square foot facility that our hot shop sits in.
Yes.
And it was inspired by the shape of beehive sawdust burners, which were the industrial mechanism that created the toxic sludge that Tacoma was built on. So Arthur Erickson really wanted to honor that industrial history, especially since glass blowing is such a, you know, industrial medium.
Yeah.
So that hot shop, originally we were going to be a Dale Chihuly inspired museum. But he was actually the one that said, hey, no, let's use this hot shop that sits adjacent to your galleries to invite artists here to Tacoma to keep the art medium moving forward, is kind of where we are today.
Yes. I say that's pretty incredible. You don't have to hear a famous artist like, no, save my name and bring everyone else in. Like that's awesome.
Yeah, if you really wanted to get to why here, like why Tacoma, why the Northwest.
Yes, please.
That spirit of Dale's is it. And Dale is it in a large way. Yeah. Oh. So he was born here up the hill, I think I've heard like a mile and a half from where we're sitting here in the museum.
A stone's throw from the sludge.
right. In 1941, so God knows what was in the sludge. But he went to UW, University of Washington, up in Seattle, and he got interested in glass through stained glass. He was there in 1961. He started pursuing ways to learn about molten glass. He actually blew his first glass bubble in his basement with, like, stained glass melted down in a plumber pipe.
It's, like, good, well-ventilated, yeah, good technology. Super safe. The way you want to do industrial at.
Yeah. So he went to University of Wisconsin-Madison, which had just started the first glassblowing program, like, a year before. Okay. And then he went to Rhode Island School of Design back east and helped found their, like, first formal program.
That's another feather in the cap.
So he's in his late 20s learning how to do all this. And then in 1968, so he's 27 years old, he receives a Fulbright fellowship to go to Murano, Italy.
Oh, tough life.
Right. Really hard. Well, the crazy thing about Murano is it is an, like, pretty ancient hub of glassmaking. In the 1200s, the city of Venice gets tired of burning down every time there's... No, really, seriously. They get tired of burning down every time there's a fire.
Yep.
So they banish all of the glass artists to this, like, sub-island of Murano. And because of that, they just sort of percolate into this really protected, you know, uber elite glassblowing team. So, back to 1968.
I gotta say, that's why I love history. It's little things like that.
Yeah,
the city, like, burned down too much, and we just said no more glass.
Literally, city council was like, if we put them all on an island, they can burn each other down, and we don't have to worry about it. And that's pretty much what happened for 800 years. They just, and the factories got so secretive and so protected that they just became insular, and they stopped talking to each other so they could always have the best technique. So
that's cool.
Dale receives the first Fulbright awarded for anyone to go observe this glassmaking community.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And it blows his mind.
So did he have to get, like, secret passwords at that point?
Yeah, well, he has to sort of earn his keep. So what he observes is this team... collaborative method of glassmaking. It takes, depending on what you're making, 2 to 6 people to make a piece of glass. And everybody has a specific job that works together like a dance, like a ballet.
Yes.
And Dale is really inspired by that, and he brings everything he learned to Murano back, first to RISD, and was teaching it there. And then he and some of his artist colleagues in 1971 said, hey, what if we created a place where artists could learn from other artists, and, you know, we could keep that collaborative glassblowing technique going. And so he returns home here to the Northwest, and a patron, Anne and John Hauberg, said, hey, come use our farm up north of Everett in Stanwood.
Yep.
All the space you could want in the forest. And that was the first summer of what is now known as Pilchuck Glass School, which is here in the Northwest and is, if not the best, within the top 3 places to learn glass in the world.
Not bad for a farm north of Everett.
Right, not bad. And a bunch of hippies with a tent and a furnace, which is pretty much how it was.
Yeah.
There are photos probably in a lot of archives of the tent and the horses and the mud.
Oh, yeah.
And the hippies.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
I remember seeing them flipping through and strolling through the museum. Just looks almost like a circus tent, just big circle tent with ovens on the outside.
Exactly. So that, though, you know, it gains momentum because there's this community of artists that really want to learn.
Yeah.
And but there aren't very many of them.
Mm.
So annually they start coming out to Pilchuck in the summer.
Okay.
I assume because it's the only time you want to live outdoors here in the Northwest.
It's not that bad.
it's January.
I'm sorry. I'm biased. We know.
So that in itself is one of the reasons we're here. But the 70s transitioning into the 80s hits a bunch of other really important historical buckets here in the Northwest.
Okay.
Because of companies like Weyerhaeuser and Boeing and Microsoft, there start to be a group of people here wealthy enough to buy art.
Yes.
So having those families adjacent to artists like Dale starts to create this little mini economy.
Oh, okay.
We have a couple of galleries. William Traver Gallery in Seattle used to have a second satellite location here. But they, you know, with these artists and Dale, start to sell glass art, which then means that artists have enough income to make their own private studios. And thanks to, you know, Tacoma and Ballard and other industrial neighborhoods, Soto, Georgetown, there's space to make glass furnaces. So then you have artists that have enough demand to need their own studio instead of just using Pilchuck or other places. And with that demand, they need help so they can hire people. So then they are contributing to new artists, learning the material. Because they need new artists, places like University of Washington and Pratt Fine Arts Center and the Shack and Everett and Hilltop Artists down here start to teach artists because they're needed. So then it just starts to snowball.
This guy literally is single-handedly going from cottage industry to regional industry.
And then a lot of it was, you know, right place, right time type of stuff. But there were just the right amount of factors here in the Northwest to really help grow into what we are today.
That is incredible.
It's great. It's great. And it only has really been, Pilchuck just celebrated their 50th anniversary last year in 2021. So it's definitely still happening. And what I like about being here is that we get to celebrate that history, but also be, because of our hot shop, what is helping
Definitely
move things forward.
Yeah, it's still blows my mind. You look up, you know, famous glassblowing places on Earth, and it's like, as we said, little island in Italy, a couple points in like France and Morocco, and wonderful Tacoma. Like,
wonderful Tacoma. Really? And it's weird because all of the places in the U.S. are in Tacoma-like places.
Yeah.
Arguably the other even bigger glass museum is Corning Museum of Glass, and the only thing famous about Corning, New York, was Pyrex and Gorilla Glass and nearby Rochester. So just because it has glass as an industrial material too, it tends to crop up in really practical places like Tacoma.
I think that the museum does an awesome job of showing both the industrial history, because I feel a lot of people forget that glass is an industrial material.
Right.
But it's then everywhere. You also bring it to the artistic side, obviously.
Yeah. And a lot of artists themselves work that transition because there's, you know, they have to bring home dinner. So a lot of work, the companies like Glassy Baby, which is a local artisanal glass making shop. But they, like, for all your, I got my mother-in-law one of those for Christmas, like, thoughts, they employ 30 artists that get to do their own personal artwork because there's a company like Glassy Baby that's willing to pay them.
And you see it everywhere around Tacoma, like especially around the holidays. It's like our seasonal, you know, pumpkin of 2021, seasonal ornament of 2022. It's like,
wow, ornaments.
Literally every holiday has a different yearly design.
Yeah.
And, you know, just you know, checking some of the online sales, like, wow, people are like hunting these from like a decade ago. It is an incredible, I don't even want to say subculture, like major cultural point of Tacoma in this region.
Absolutely. And if you were to go a little south, another place that I'm excited about that's starting to get some serious like attention as an art form are pipes. They're incredible. And a lot of those artists live, you know, between here and kind of Eugene, Oregon. So to have like a functional glass, but have it really take on its own artwork and have a collector level status is like super crazy.
No, that's incredible. Scaling back down a bit from, you know, the region and the history of glass. Can you tell me a little bit more just about what's going on in the museum? Any, you know, favorite exhibits you have?
I feel like we're still not far enough removed to just say that we're open and very safe. And we're gearing up to celebrate actually our 20th birthday this summer, which is crazy for us.
Yeah.
It feels like we were just talking about our reopening. so for the interesting part of, well, one of many interesting parts about COVID, which I hope you hope one day have a podcast where you don't have to talk about COVID.
It'll be a great day one day.
As you can imagine, glass blowing is not an easy thing to do when you share a blowpipe with strangers from around the world.
Yeah, not bad for an upper respiratory.
No, it's not a great thing. So we are excited, though. It feels like this summer is going to be the point when artists from are comfortable collaborating and working together again. So one of the things we're looking forward to is really getting back to business with our visiting artist program.
Okay.
On a typical, you know, normal year, we have between 30 and 40 artists that come to work in our hot shop.
Oh, that's incredible.
They come from here, from around the world. Mm-hmm. Like, we have an artist on Wallström in March that's coming from Sweden.
Oh,
and
nice.
Books 2 weeks in the hot shop every year because they're the only people that can help her make her work.
Is it just like one artist who comes, or do they bring their whole team?
They bring, they take, it like, depends the on local... the person. Yeah, there's, okay. They're welcome to bring whoever. But we have a fabulous hot shop team.
Yes.
Here in the museum, and they are always the core four people that help. Okay.
I gotta say, that's one of my favorite parts of this museum, just that you have the viewing arena built into the hot shop.
So. Man, and a pro tip, we just opened, as a side note, a new cafe in Kalmo.
Oh, okay.
And my favorite thing to do is to get lunch to go and eat it in the hot shop. It's the best.
Hey, dinner and a show.
Yeah, exactly. But having the rotation of artists and getting to see a different project every week really is the heart and soul of what we do. So we've been missing that energy here a lot in the last 2 years.
So glad it's on its way back.
Yeah, it's totally. We've been enjoying mostly local artists who don't have to get on a plane and travel here. So we've been.
Makes sense.
I think we've had maybe a dozen residencies since we reopened. So we're there, and in between, the hotshop team always has something exciting going on.
But, yeah, definitely.
We have a couple of new exhibitions coming between now and the summer. We were really lucky to receive a pretty remarkable 300 or 400 object collection from a former board member of ours, his Robert Minkoff. And we are showcasing sort of the biggest, the greatest hits and best and brightest from his collection in an exhibition called Boundless Curiosity, which opens on April 2nd.
Boundless Curiosity.
And it, what I'm excited, I've been really loving learning about the collection because Robert, our collector, was really tenacious about saying, okay, that's something new in glass. Who's doing it the best, and how can I own what they made?
That is the kind of collector you want to have.
Yeah, and the collection is really diverse. There is, for example, a full Lazy Boy size armchair that's made of this really thin spider web of glass.
That's insane.
Yeah, and a big, maybe a your height, a more than 6 foot tall glass panel that hangs on the wall.
Okay.
It's made of a solid sheet of really colorful detailed glass.
That's insane.
So it's just if you want to see all of the possibilities of what you can do with glass as an art medium, it's going to be it's going to be in this show.
I think that's something that people definitely need to come here to learn about, just because you think of glassware, people think like, oh yeah, there's like bowls and I saw a chandelier once. It's like, no, they can make massive pieces.
Totally. And we sort of tend to get stuck in the, you know, that's what I got as a wedding gift, the Waterford crystal part, which we actually do have downstairs right now. We have an Art Deco show of works by Renee Lalique that'll be up through the summer.
Nice.
If you want to, like, learn more about why what your grandma gave you for a wedding gift is so important. And then the other exhibition, we're going to refresh our permanent collection gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing it along with the music that artists listen to while they work in the hot shop. So we're asking each artist to make a Spotify playlist for what they listen to while they make the things in the gallery. So just to keep the, it's hard. The hot shop is such a magnetic draw that we're always working on, you know, if you've been to the museum, we have that big grand hall.
Yep.
So we're working on keeping that environment and that experience happening in the gallery.
Okay.
So that'll be a fun,
Totally,
twist on what
totally immersive experience.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
Get the
and
just
juices
flowing.
I was thinking about it a lot as, all the articles last year about working from home and reinvigorating your workspace. So having artists do have been working from home forever.
Yeah. Sadly, yes.
So to sort of take that thing and maybe help people revitalize their, you know, new
that's
reality.
That's awesome. One of the fun little pieces of the museum that I really enjoy is just seeing all the children's art collaborations in the front hallway. Do you have any favorite pieces of that? Yeah. Are you gonna try to expand that?
Yeah, yeah. So those are from our Kids Design Glass program, which we're still doing.
Okay.
Once a month during the school year, so September to May, and the way those pieces come about is that kids age 12 and under submit drawings with artist statements to our Hot Shop, and they pick one a month.
Mm-hmm.
And invite the kid and their family to the Hot Shop to be the designer.
Oh, nice.
While they recreate that drawing as faithfully as they can.
Yeah.
Which is always adorable.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the youngest one we have was made by a 2-year-old. It is so cute. So the family gets to come, and then the Hot Shop team makes two. So mm-hmm. the kid and the family get to walk away with one. Okay. And we keep the other for our collection.
Oh, nice.
So they're always a big hit. We always have some on display.
Yeah.
And they're hilarious. My favorite one downstairs right now is Sock Nest Monster, which is the monster that takes the socks out of the dryer and eats them, which is why you don't have pairs anymore.
I knew there was something.
Yeah.
I'm glad they caught him finally.
So did 8-year-old Alex.
Now, that sounds awesome. And just for those of you who've never actually seen a normal Hot Shop, let alone the massive one here in the museum, it is... The only way I can describe it is like just massive ovens full of what looks like molten magma.
It is actually hotter than magma.
Oh,
so,
wow.
One of my fun facts is that the lava that comes out of Kilauea on Hawaii is 2,100 degrees, mm-hmm. and the glass in our furnace is 2,300.
Bragging rights, no big deal.
Yeah, right. So if you can't get to Hawaii, come when we open the door, you'll feel like you're there.
Yeah, definitely an awesome thing to see. Thinking a bit outside the museum, are you guys involved with the Chihuly Bridge and overhang and
all of those things? Yes and no.
Okay.
So the bridge of glass is what connects the museum over the railway tracks to Pacific Avenue and UWT and the courthouse.
Yes.
Dale designed it with Arthur Erickson when we were being built.
Okay.
And the city of Tacoma funded it. So it was built by the city as a sort of a welcome to the family for the museum. And it is...
Not a bad welcome gift.
Not a bad welcome. And it is a cool way to get a good cup of coffee from here.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Between the underwater scene and just all the different vases. And I'm drawing a blank on the actual collection names right now.
Yeah, there's
the Venetians.
There's a Venetian wall. There's two big... They kind of look like rock candies.
Yeah,
like
glacier
they're like,
columns.
Yeah,
or
they're
something.
Like 35 feet tall. And then there's the C-form installation that
you
walk under.
Thank you. I love, just walking that, and especially with out-of-town friends, and like, there's a lot of, like, weird glass things here. It's like, you realize this is, like, priceless art just over the highway.
Yeah, exactly. And
real casual.
And if you want more priceless art, there's more, if you get into the courthouse, they have a whole bunch
it's
of
like,
deals work also. It's everywhere.
The Chihuly Trail from the courthouse to over the bridge to the museum.
Well,
all
like
downtown,
we were saying, he's
Seattle.
Our celebrated, son.
Yeah. Absolutely incredible. Do you have any favorite little stories from the Glass Museum or any specific exhibits that come to mind that you enjoy here?
Man, so many. A lot of people ask us if you're out in front of the museum between the entrance and Social Bar and Grill, there's a giant pool installation. That story on that, it's called Fluent Steps.
Yes.
It was designed by Martin Blank, who was a pretty prominent member of Dale Chihuly's team, who then became his own artwork.
Not to sound totally random in this, but I've watched a lot of Chihuly's glassblowing videos. Is Martin Blank the famous gray tank top dude with the long hair?
That is William Morris.
He has a name.
He has a name and a legacy.
Everyone was like, who's gray tank top dude that is always around you?
That's Billy
He's
Morris.
Just gray tank top dude. Okay, well, there's a name to that mystery.
Yes.
Sorry, go on.
I solved it for you. So Martin came to the museum shortly after we opened.
Mm-hmm.
The pools were originally designed by Arthur Erickson to be art
naturally
installations. Because why not put glass in a giant pool? So Martin, over I think like 64 days of residencies, made Fluent Steps, and
that's incredible.
Inspired by the steam evaporating off of a cup of coffee. So we got cool Northwest theme.
Say in the summertime, just like the sun hits the water just right, reflecting, refracting through it. It's
totally
so gorgeous.
It is a cool, you don't even have to come in the building to see
the
glass. what other stories
So I highly recommend you do go in the building, though. There's incredible stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. The person that really has good stories is our Hotshot director, Ben Cobb. There's always with, we've been lucky to have Dale and his team come for residencies, mm-hmm. Throughout the years. Those are always kind of crazy, surreal events.
Yeah, I believe it.
What I've really enjoyed about working here is how many communities are impacted by glass. We had an exhibition a while ago now, maybe 6 or 8 years ago, of engravers from Waterford, Ireland. So the crystal, things you got for your wedding gift, that company's trademark was sold and purchased by a Japanese conglomerate.
Mm-hmm.
So the result has been the reduction of their factory.
Oh, no.
So there's this community of master engravers that have had a series of them over for residencies, like the gentleman who designs awards for the Queen. Or, the Olympic torch, torch.
Real casual little items.
Right. But they have always worked for Waterford. They've never had any creative space to do their own thing. So Irish artist named Roisin de Boutlier came here and made them blown glass blanks to try to engrave their own stuff for the first time. So we got to display that here and then send it to Dublin.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice. So there's also around the world, there are communities that are impacted by glass. So it is fun to bring all of those stories here to Tacoma.
Yeah. That's awesome that you can serve as that hub.
Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
For all you listeners out there, that was Katie Buckingham, the curator of the Museum of Glass on the Foss Waterway in downtown Tacoma. Highly recommend you come check out this literal global hub of creativity and beauty. Katie, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I hope you guys will come down and see the museum.
Looking forward to it. This has been Joe Boma with another Grit City story.